think the church is a beautiful letdown. I think I'm a beautiful letdown. I think that that's what confession is, confessing the beauty, the pain, the heartache.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. And here on the show, we speak to a different Christian each week and hear something of their life story. I'm really pleased to say that my guest this week is John Foreman. John is the lead singer of Switchfoot. The band has sold almost 10 million records worldwide and played sold-out concerts in over 40 nations. They've recently been touring the world with The Beautiful Letdown. That album was first released in 2003 and launched the band to new heights, with songs such as Dare You to Move, This Is Your Life, and Meant to Live being enjoyed both inside and outside of the church. The band have since revisited and re-released a new version of that record, taking it across the US and over to the UK with shows in London, Birmingham, Leeds, as well as the Netherlands and Dublin, Ireland. John is also a successful solo artist in his own right. And John is currently on tour with Switchfoot across the US, and he joins me right now. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. So just tell me exactly where you are in the world right now and what's going on in your life today.
Mobile, Alabama. We are on tours playing The Beautiful Letdown. It was a beautiful letdown when you found me here.
Every once in every moon, I see everything clear. I'll be a beautiful letdown.
It's been 20 years since that record came out, and this is kind of a birthday party to a record that means so much to us and to a lot of people out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great place to start, isn't it? That record was absolutely huge, as I mentioned in the introduction. I guess it, in many ways, launched your career to a huge number of new people who hadn't come across you before. You've had 20 years to reflect now on that success. What was it about that album, about those songs, about that moment in time that so resonated with so many people?
Looking back, what is it? Hindsight is the only perfect science. You'd think I'd have more of an understanding of how those songs connected so well with people. I think as a songwriter, my goal is always to be honest and to bring something that feels true and important of myself into the song, and you know, sometimes those connect in ways that feel really immediate. It's ironic that a song you can write at 3 a.m. that you're wrestling with something you wonder if anyone has ever felt in their life, that you feel like you're alone in singing it, that's the song that somebody else halfway across the planet says, no, I know exactly what you mean, that's my song. I couldn't have said it better myself. And so that's what I love about music, is the connection that it affords us, and the intangibles. So I guess I still don't understand how it works, but I'm thankful for the connection that these songs have had.
Sure. I mean, for you, is there an overarching theme to the record that stands out, or is an individual track or two that for you just perhaps means more now than it did 20 years ago?
Yeah, the whole album, I mean, centering around the theme of the title, The Beautiful Letdown, you know, I think that there's layers to that title. As a band, it was a beautiful letdown to be signed to a major label and then subsequently dropped before the record ever came out. So that was a beautiful letdown right there. I think in the song itself, it unpacks that concept a little bit more. I think the church is a beautiful letdown. I think I'm a beautiful letdown. I think that that's what confession is. At its best, it's confessing the beauty, the pain, the heartache, and moving forward, you know. And I think this album encapsulates a lot of what we were dealing with at the time as a band. You know, we were thinking this was our last album as a band. Let's go out and make one more beautiful, honest record, and then we'll go get day job, you know? So yeah, that was kind of where we were at, and that's what the record was at the time.
Yeah. Do you remember a moment in your life where you realized, wow, I'm wrong. This isn't the last Switchfoot Records. We're not going to need to go and find other jobs. This thing is, I mean, presumably there was a moment you realized this has kind of blown up beyond my wildest imaginations, and more people are hearing this music than perhaps you ever could have imagined. Do you remember that moment of realizing you got it wrong and things were looking up maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a wild ride because we have outlasted a lot of the musical trends that we never seem to fit in with, you know, ska and swing and, you know, all, whatever the current flavor of the month is. And what we were on a radio show at Madison Square Garden, where you've got Destiny's Child and Maroon 5 and, you know, all these different bands and musical artists. There's a TV personality who's introducing the band before us, walking off stage, this guy named Donald Trump. It's a strange collection of souls in Madison Square Garden that night. And I remember thinking to myself, certainly not belonging. And kind of caught up with the irony of it all. But I do remember thinking, okay, so this is a strange occupation that has brought us here. And I do feel like we have something to say to the people of New York that evening. I remember we played Dare You to Move and Meant to Live acoustic. And, you know, everyone's singing along with their lighters out and cell phone lights on. And I just remember feeling grateful, a lot of gratitude, you know, for many moments like that over the years where you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned Day to Move and Meant to Live came to mind as well. A lyric like "We were meant to live for so much more." I think for most Christians hearing that, we think, yeah, we are meant to live for so much more. And, you know, God has a bigger plan and purpose. And there's a kind of spiritual connection for a lot of Christians. But I guess what's been true of a lot of your music is it's transcended the walls of the church. And you have many fans who won't share your Christian faith and can sing that song with their own meaning attached to it. When you wrote a song like that, and when you write songs, how much at the forefront is some of those spiritual meanings for you personally?
Yeah. Well, I went to university, UCSD. It's a school where everyone's becoming doctors and kind of more of an empirical mindset, a materialist in the philosophical sense. And, you know, my conversations at night, I was pretty much one of the only Christians in the dorm, you know, and I loved it because I felt like it was it felt like this was a conversation. I mean, every night my roommate and I would have long conversation. He was a determinist, you know, and so that's kind of a conversation that you can have forever, determinist versus whether you have agency in the world. And so I think in many ways I still write my songs for my dorm mates, you know. And for myself, you know, certainly. But I find Kierkegaard's delineation between Christendom and the church to be really helpful, because I feel like ultimately there's the business of the church. There's Christendom. There's the things that we stamp as Christian and we sell them. There's the things that the kind of the team spirit of they're on our team or they're not. And I understand all of that, but I feel like that in many ways is unhelpful to unpacking what's in here. And when I meet someone at a coffee shop, in a park, at a pub, you know, these delineations of black or white, Republican, Democrat, Christian, atheist, I think that they are extremely unhelpful in connecting with the heart of who we really are, you know. They might be helpful at a zoo and labeling something behind bars that is fixed and static. But none of us are that. You know, we are all changing and growing and learning. And so I think that's the beauty of a song, is it doesn't force you to declare your identity before you begin to listen. It is agnostic in that regard, where it allows you to take the song for what it is. And for that reason, it sneaks past the watchful dragons of religion, whatever your religion might be, atheism, you know, Jewish, Buddhist, whatever. I feel like that is what I love about music, is that we all can find ourselves in the song, lose ourselves in the song, and maybe by the time the song's over, we've become a different person as well. Arguments and failed attempts to
fly. We were meant to live for so much more. Yeah, and music, as you say, has that incredible ability to break down some of our barriers and to bring people together. You know, how much, like, are you aware of that on any given night when you're performing? You think you're looking out over hundreds, thousands of people, and as you say, they may not have anything in common politically or in their faith or in any other ways, and yet there's that moment where everyone's coming together and quite literally singing the same song. Is there, like, do you recognize the kind of power of that?
I do, and I feel like it is a strangely eroded portion of human existence, is that connectivity. I feel like the means that we have of connecting now erode at that sense of unity in many ways, where, you know, certainly Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and news chat groups, whatever it is, however we connect, I don't think we would communicate the same way if we were sitting next to someone, looking them in the eye. You know, the medium is the message. I feel like in so many ways, music is one of the last places where music and sports, where you can stand next to someone you completely disagree with, hold your hands up in the air, you know, hug, cry, weep, laugh together, and leave with an understanding of how much we all have in common. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Well, here on the show, we always like to go back to the very beginning of a person's life. We haven't quite gone back to the beginning. You've told me a little bit about university, but should we go back even before that? I'd love to hear a bit about kind of life growing up, your childhood, where faith first came into the mix for you, and what your upbringing was like.
I think it's a beautiful thing. When you're a kid, you think everyone grows up the way you do, because that's just what you know. My dad was a pastor, and so I grew up in the church. But I think the uniqueness of who my dad was lost on me, because you only get one, you know? And so my dad was the guy who taught me how to play Stairway to Heaven when I got really into Led Zeppelin, which to people listening who might not have grown up in the church, doesn't seem that odd to have Stairway to Heaven be your first song that your dad teaches you on the guitar. Except in the church, Zeppelin was one of those bands that you did not play. And so this was a taboo that he kind of walked us through with music. You know, we were into the Beatles and Zeppelin and the Stones and the Police and U2. And I think we grew up without a clear delineation of sacred and secular in a beautiful way. The idea that this is art, this is someone's artistic expression. Let's speak of it with a reverence that's deserving of art. This is what this guy is bringing forth in this song. How does it make you feel? What are the themes? What does the lyric mean to you? How does it resonate? So the irony is, me, when we moved to California, back to California when I was in ninth grade, I start playing Zeppelin in the youth group, and all the kids freak out, like, no, you can't do that. That's taboo. It's off limits. That's one of those bands you can't touch. U2, you can play them, but not Zeppelin. And I think that exemplifies kind of the way I grew up, was not really seeing a delineation between sacred and secular, but seeing all of the earth as, you know, God's sacred playground. And so that might exemplify my mindset and where I'm coming from with music.
Absolutely. I mean, I can resonate with a lot of that, John, because my dad taught me to play guitar. My dad pastor, and my dad likes a bit of Led Zeppelin. So, I mean, I notice there's sometimes there's a difference between the UK and the US and some of our Christian culture. I can think of friends in the US who as a teenager thought the way to follow Jesus is to burn all of my secular music. And clearly that exists in some pockets, perhaps, of US evangelical culture, but it wasn't my background growing up as a Christian in the UK, or most of my friends, where we were, as you say, able to enjoy the music, whether it had a secular or a Christian label on it, was a little bit more irrelevant over here, perhaps. I mean, is it fair to say that parts of American culture can be very binary? I mean, we see this at the moment in your politics, where you have to be red or you have to be blue, and sometimes there's not much in between.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that these labels are, unhelpful for me particularly. I feel like you turn faith into some sort of weird team sport where, I mean, when I'm reading the gospel, I'm encountering this iconoclast who is so open with everyone except for the religious establishment. He's meeting people where they're at and loving them. And I feel like ultimately love is the power that changes us. Dogma rarely changes my mind. You can come to me with all the statistics and rhetoric that you want, but that will go, that falls flat compared to, you know, helping me when I need it. When you show up when I'm broken and hurt, and you give me your time and have an ear for me, I'm ready to listen, you know. And I think that's true for Republican, Democrat, whatever. I do think that there's a binary spirit in our age. I mean, I think it's reflective of the coding. It's one or a zero, you know, it's either or. There is no synthesis, there's no us, there's you or me, and I think that's not the gospel that I encounter.
Yeah. So, obviously with your dad being a pastor, faith was there from the beginning, but, you know, it had to become your own at some point, and clearly it now is your own. What were the moments in childhood or teens where you felt like this wasn't just something dad believed in, this was something that was real to me?
That's a great question. And I do think the overarching story in contemporary Christian circles, at least in the West, is often a before-after story, you know, which is, you know, I was blind, but now I see. And it is that. But I think it's a continuing process. I think that I've come to see myself and the fellow souls around me. We all are gardens that are continuing to grow and hopefully produce fruit. And maybe old crops die and we learn and we grow and change. Or maybe if you want to use a different analogy instead of the garden, you can use a relationship. To think that I've ever completely figured out my wife would be a misnomer. To say now I was lost and now I'm found, you know, I think in every relationship there's an unfolding, a growing, you know, and I think for me that is certainly the case. I want to continue to become, understand, grow, learn, and I think that as a surfer, I think of the ocean. There's never a moment in time where I can say I've got the ocean figured out. The ocean will ever be a mystery, and as it is with my faith.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs,
near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
I think a lot of people can identify with that idea that faith is changing, it's evolving. As you say, like any relationship, it changes over time. I wanted to ask you specifically, you know, how has your Christian faith changed over time? I don't know. I know you're a deep thinker. You've already quoted Kierkegaard on this in this interview. But, you know, when faith changes, is it on that intellectual level? Is it on the kind of more personal level? How has faith changed? How has faith evolved over the years?
That's a great question. I think as embodied souls on the planet, we can talk philosophically about the mental processes, but ultimately it's what we do with our actions and our time here on the planet that is ultimately, it feels much more substantial, the way we treat each other, and the way we love and are loved. I think for me, this particular season has been a season of wanting to reconnect with really the simple truths of being loved by my Maker. I think for me, believing in an entity that created the heavens and the earth, I look around at so much beauty that can be unaccounted for me without the presence of some deity. I think that the faith leap for me is usually, can this deity love and interact with myself? That's where the faith journey begins for me most days. And so that's what I've been trying to reconnect with.
I love what you said in the past about songwriting, that you write songs about things you don't understand, and you list, you know, God being one of them, politics, I think, being another. I wonder if in the process of writing songs, does it help you process your faith, deal with these big questions, not necessarily have all the answers, but does, in the process of writing songs, does it help your understanding? Does it enhance your faith in some way?
Songwriting absolutely helps me be me. My wife, she'll say, you know, that the songs help her understand what's been on my mind. I have a hard time, maybe to go back a little bit, we moved around a lot when I was a kid. And one of the moves, I had a really hard time making friends. And, you know, it was a dark season. I started stuttering. And music at that moment was a place where I could communicate clearly. And so the song felt like a form of communication that didn't stutter and felt more true than something I could say in prose or conversation. And so I absolutely think that songs for me have been a place where I can, it's a vehicle where I can begin with darkness and aim for the light.
So many of your songs, as you say, transcend that sacred, secular divide that people like to put up. There are a couple of songs you've done, which I think you could, depending on definitions, kind of class as worship songs. Now, you've sung songs that are very worshipful, that could almost be used sometimes in a congregational worship setting. Have you ever been asked to do a whole album just to worship songs?
So the reason why those songs exist in the first place is because my wife asked for that album. She said, I asked her what did she want for Christmas, or her birthday, I think it was, and She said, I want you to make a worship record. And so I started, like, you know, figuring out Chris Tomlin songs. And she said, no, you, not other people's songs. I want you to write it. And so, yeah, that's why those songs existed in the first place. I think music, all music is worship. I think that worship is what we do with our time, our energy, our thoughts. And I think music is certainly an extension of that. And the corporate worship in the Christian church is something that I grew up in. I think it was because it felt so intrinsic. It was actually, those are sometimes the hardest songs to write, because it feels like, how do I enter into this authentically from a place that feels real and genuine and also unique, you know?
Yeah. I mean, people have sometimes criticized worship songs as all sounding the same. Is that what you mean by wanting to do something that's unique and doesn't just sound like what has effectively become a bit of a genre, where some people have said it's all just kind of the basic same chords and the basic same kind of lyrics? I mean, do you think there's any, is that a fair criticism?
Yeah, I mean, but you could say that about anything. I mean, you listen to any station long enough, you could, what is C.S. Lewis, his least favorite word is just, you know, the country music station is just songs about your dog dying and a beer in the back of your truck. You know, I mean, Christian music is just this. I think you could say that about any genre. Led Zeppelin is just this, you know, but I think ultimately I find, any genre, there's compelling stuff there too. You know, I feel like there's so many songs that move me within the corporate worship setting and are beautiful. That's certainly the case.
How would you describe your calling? What gets you up out of bed in the morning each day? What's it all about for you?
The embodied human rarely has one calling that I think, for me, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a member of a community, I'm in a band, you know, I'm in Mobile, Alabama today. You know, so I think my calling is to be present to the multitude of places where I am, and that, you know, here in this park, I don't know, there might be someone that is a conversation. I mean, I think that, yeah, maybe my calling is to be present.
Is that hard to
I
do?
Think exceptionally hard, especially with these devices and the ever-present omnipotence in our pocket, you know, that we feel with a couple clicks of a button, we can be anywhere and know anything. It's really hard to be present to the particulars that are around us.
What are the sorts of things that you've been trying to do to be more present, or to make that a bit easier? Have you found any tips you can share with those of us who might be struggling with the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say I really like books. I love feeling the paper, dog earing and underlining. I love writing in journals. I think for any songwriters out there who might be listening, I challenge you to, instead of writing in an iPhone right in here, trying to write with pen and paper. I feel like it integrates a different portion of your brain when you write with pen and ink than when you write with your fingers on a screen. And I do think that Yeah, shutting the phone off, putting it away, not having it out at dinner, but in a drawer somewhere. I think these are all things that have they can help to put it in its place. I mean, like any tool, it's a knife. It goes both ways, right? So it is a beautiful, amazing tool that when it masters us, it's problematic. But yeah, and also I think the social media portion, I mean, that's the when I was coming up, the way we found out about music, NME or Spin or Rolling Stone, these magazines, now every single music maker is their own advertising agency, for better and for worse. So I suppose you could call it a necessary evil, but the evil is right there as necessary as it might be. So I many times I'll stockpile a bunch of things to talk about a record or something, but then I'll try and turn my phone off for the week and not feel like it's a part of me.
I guess there's that pressure, as you say, to kind of self-promote, to promote your work, to be on these social channels, to put everything out there. And to a certain extent, unless you're willing to do that, one could argue, people aren't going to hear your music or read your book or whatever it is. But it sounds like that can be a bit of a struggle as well. And I know it is for a lot of really talented artists who love making the thing, but perhaps feel a bit uncomfortable about the promotion or the self-promotion. Any words of advice for people who might be struggling to get over that hurdle of kind of they'd say, "Well, don't want to make it all about me or brag," or especially for Christians who believe in humility, how am I supposed to open up Instagram and tell everyone how this song I've written is the best thing ever and you should all come hear my show next week?
Yeah. I mean, I love the dialogue. I think that it is so funny that the Insta brag culture, and truthfully, I think it is it's a part of a larger question, of who we are as humans and who we're becoming and what we want to pass on to our children. I think about that all the time. I've got a little girl and a little boy, and I think about growing up, in the 90s. It was a simpler time, and we got into trouble with skateboards and all the things that feel pretty benign compared to the internet, Yeah, and I certainly don't pretend to have anything figured out, but I think the struggle and the wrestling with it is valid and needed. I'm not going to be the one with the answers, but I'm here at the table trying to figure it out too.
Yeah. You mentioned a few moments ago that you love reading, and so I'd be great to hear what are the best books that you have read recently that you would recommend to others.
I just read a book, fictional, I mean, nonfiction, How to Say Babylon. I can't remember the author, but she is a woman who grew up in Jamaica. And it was an amazing unpacking of Rasta, and it was, yeah, I really enjoyed it. She's a poet and has such a fire in the way she speaks. I just finished The Master and His Emissary, Ian McGilchrist, and that's a mouthful. It's definitely if you read it, it's gonna be with you for a little while. But I really love the implications of his work. He talks about the two hemispheres that we all have inside here and how every human takes in the world with these right and left hemispheres, and everything that we see around us that's created by humans was created by these two hemispheres, and the implications of that. And yeah, it's a tremendous book about how we think, how we understand, how we move forward.
What does What does church look like for you? And I guess one of the reasons I want to ask this question is I imagine it could be challenging given you are on tour so much, and I imagine that comes with its challenges. But, you know, I mean, we readers of Premier Christianity magazine from every Christian denomination, every type of different church background. It's always just interesting to hear what people's experiences are of local church and kind of the place that holds in your life and in your spirituality.
Yeah. So I grew up Calvary Chapel, non-denominational, my parents were in the Jesus movement, you know, long-haired hippie Californian type.
The revival of the kind of 60s and 70s and the hippies, and it's an amazing portion of kind of church history for those who don't know, the kind of counterculture, and made its way over here to the UK as well, and out of it a little magazine called Buzz Magazine was birthed in 1965, which is now Premier Christianity Magazine. So we know a little bit about that kind of portion of church history, if I could put it that way. But it sounds like a fascinating time.
Yeah. And again, you grow up thinking that is what is normal, you know, that was how I grew up. It is a challenge, certainly, to try and find how to stay connected when the job that I have requires me to be gone on the weekends, most weekends of the year, you know. So it has been a beautiful thing to, I think, again, when you unpack, to go back to the Kierkegaard's understanding of the church versus Christendom, knowing the church can happen anywhere, it's not the building, that we've had some incredible moments with people on the road, you know, a Bible study with folks that come from a totally different understanding of the world and have insights of their own. That they've been some of my favorite moments of church, you know, in the past few years. So that has been a beautiful sideline of not being able to be at home for Sunday.
Well, we are grateful to you giving up your weekends and not least coming over to the UK very soon for the beautiful Let Down World Tour. Looking forward to it. Wanted to talk a bit more about Switchfoot and about your music. You're in this really interesting, I guess, portion of your career where you are now looking back at past work. Can you let us know how much you're looking to the future, though, John? What can Switchfoot fans expect next after the beautiful Let Down World Tour? Will there be some new music on the way, or is it all looking back now?
Yes. It has been fun to re-examine the beautiful Let Down. It's been a beautiful celebration of the past. What an honor to have these songs come to join your stories around the world. You know, to think that a song that I wrote in Southern California at 3 o'clock in the morning could make its way over to the UK, you know, I mean, that is a true gift. And I think as a songwriter who has been so affected by other people's songs, that these songs of, you know, whether it's Sufjan Stevens or James Taylor or the Beatles or Zeppelin or whoever, that they have been a scaffolding for my soul to get to places that I could have never gone otherwise. To think that our songs could be that for you, again, that's the highest honor as a songwriter and worthy of celebrating. So this entire season, you know, whether it's Tyler from 21 Pilots or John Pellion or Jonas Brothers, One Republic, all these different people who cover the songs. All of that, I'm so grateful. And yet, it has been also this thing where I'm like jonesing to play new songs for everybody. So certainly the solo project In Bloom has allowed me to do that. I'm really proud of what we came up with. I'm excited to maybe get a chance to tour those songs a little bit in 2025. And I'm also really looking forward to playing the world what we've been dreaming up as a band. So yeah, new music on the way. Nothing to say about sliding where we've been, but I'm so excited to move forward.
Well, that's brilliant to hear. Well, seeing as we are on the radio, John, it would be remiss of me not to give you an opportunity to introduce a song which we can play out. So I'll leave it up to you. If you want to say, "I'm John Foreman and this is," and select a song of your choosing and we'll play it.
Okay. Well, let's try it like this. Hello, I'm John Foreman and this is a new song called In Bloom. I hope you find it beautiful. I hope you find it nourishing, that the gardens within you would be fed. But it's a part of me that's pushing up roses. I'm a desert in bloom. I'm a desert in bloom.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.